This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, an investigation into the murder of a Saudi critic points the finger at the regime, but the US has worked against sanctions. We talk with Australia's Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne, about what the federal government will do. And why has Australia suddenly witnessed a massive spike in plane arrivals from China, India and Malaysia suddenly claiming asylum? A former immigration official says it's not about human rights, it's about trafficking.
It's about enabling the traffickers to bring the relevant individuals in, to be able to place them in jobs, usually very low-skilled jobs, around Australia. There are three main areas in which these people have traditionally worked. Firstly, on farms, secondly, in restaurants, and thirdly, in brothels.
In the Dutch city of Utrecht, a joint investigation team including Australian police announced the first of what may be many prosecutions against individuals blamed for the downing of MH17 nearly 5 years ago. Three Russians and a Ukrainian have been named and charged with the murder of 298 passengers and crew who perished on the 17th of July 2014. The problem is all the suspects remain out of reach of the Dutch court, which will begin to hear the case with or without them in March next year. Chief Foreign Correspondent Philip Williams was at the press conference where the prosecutions were announced.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
At a nondescript conference centre, an extraordinary announcement. The joint investigation team would prosecute four people it says were in the chain of command in the rebel-controlled east of Ukraine. A series of intercepted phone conversations were played to journalists, which are said to show a clear link between those at the top of the government of the breakaway enclave and the Russian army that allegedly supplied the Buk surface-to-air missile that killed 298 innocent people. Dutch Chief Prosecutor Frest Westerbeek.
At this moment, we have the leading figures of the rebels in the eastern part of Ukraine, but they also have lines into the Russian Federation.
While the Russians have been asked to hand over three suspects, it's highly unlikely that will happen. The Constitution doesn't allow extradition. But that doesn't deter Celine Fredericks, whose son and girlfriend perished in the Ukrainian fields.
It's not getting easier. Days like this bring a lot of stress, of course. No sleep at all last night. But we want this very much. We're waiting for this day for 5 years.
For Robert Van Hungen, today's news doesn't bring back his loved one, but at least it's progress.
It's a very important day because now it's clear, crystal clear, who done it. And now it's crystal clear that by the prosecuting of the four responsibles, that there is an obvious connection to Russian state.
While the relatives have welcomed today's developments, it also brings back the pain of the last 5 years. Ellie Ricker lost her sister and brother-in-law.
It's always difficult and, yeah, it still hurts.
Yeah. It brings it all back today?
Yeah. When you wake up this morning and it's hard.
The joint investigation called for more witnesses to come forward and offered a witness protection plan for those who fear punishment or worse for speaking up. The team hopes to add more names to the list of those who'll face court. Australian Federal Police Assistant Commissioner Peter Crozier.
We won't stop. So just because we know that that is a challenge for us doesn't mean that we're not going to pursue justice on behalf of those victims, on behalf of those people close to them, their family members. So we'll do all we can to look and use every avenue is available to us, every opportunity which might become available to us, to try and put those people before justice.
It's been a five-year wait for justice. It could be many more before any involved in the murder of 298 people face any real consequences. This is Philip Williams in the Netherlands, reporting for AM.
And Phil Williams was at the crash site in Ukraine right after the plane was brought down. I spoke with him earlier. Phil, you saw the debris and you've been talking with the relatives of those killed ever since. How important is today to them?
Very, very important. Even though they know that this is probably not going to end up with these people that are accused in jail. You know, I did see, things I wish I hadn't seen. You can't unsee. And you then meet the very families that were so deeply affected and remain deeply affected and remain incredibly angry and frustrated and just want justice for their loved ones. They know they can't bring them back, but they want to make sure that those that did this pay for it. And they do believe, the ones I spoke to today, I spoke to four or five, who all said, this is a positive step. Because, you know, they've been waiting 5 years for prosecutions. That's because it's incredibly difficult to gather the evidence. And they recognise that. And they hope, they really hope, that one day those perpetrators and others that have yet to be identified, will end up paying a price as they have paid a terrible price and will continue to do so for the whole of their lives.
You've just touched on this. The relatives are assuming that Russia and their allies in eastern Ukraine won't cooperate with any prosecutions. Given your experience on the ground reporting there, do you think they're right?
I think they're absolutely right. And you see the response from the Russian government through the Russian Foreign Ministry. They said it's absolutely hollow claims. And there's no doubt that they will not hand over anyone. Constitutionally, the Russians say they can't hand them over anyway. The Russian version of this whole episode is that they have tried to cooperate and been rejected by the West.
What was the attitude of the eastern Ukrainian separatists to journalists covering the crash when you were reporting there?
Well, look, I think there was deep embarrassment at the time because I was there straight after, and a sense that, you know, something terrible had happened and a mistake had been made. But then pretty quickly afterwards, there was a fairly aggressive attitude to some journalists, us included. We certainly had guns pointed at us at the many checkpoints that we went through. I know a BBC female journalist was effectively kidnapped by them, held in the basement, hooded and threatened with rape. I mean, there were some very nasty things happening there because the rebels felt that the Western press was against them. It certainly didn't help their cause by some of the actions that they perpetrated.
And that's our chief foreign correspondent, Philip Williams. A damning United Nations report has found the state of Saudi Arabia is responsible for the killing of journalist and dissident Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey last year. A UN special rapporteur recommended an international criminal investigation be opened into Mr. Khashoggi's death and that countries implement targeted sanctions against Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
UN Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard has found the killing of Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul last year was an extrajudicial execution for which Saudi Arabia is responsible. But her report doesn't directly blame the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who many accuse of ordering Jamal Khashoggi's death.
I do not have evidence regarding who has ordered the killing. What I do have is evidence suggesting that the responsibilities of high-level officials may be engaged.
What Ms. Callamard did find was that Prince Mohammed would have known about the sophisticated and well-resourced operation conducted by 15 Saudi operatives inside a Saudi diplomatic mission. She says the killing fits a pattern of repression that's been credibly linked to the Crown Prince.
There is no way the leaders of that state, including the Crown Prince, were not aware of those violations.
The report says Saudi Arabia's secretive trial of 11 unidentified suspects in the killing, five of whom are facing the death penalty, should be suspended. It recommends the implementation of targeted sanctions on the international assets of Mohammed bin Salman and the opening of a criminal investigation. The report describes audio recordings in which Saudi operatives refer to Jamal Khashoggi as the sacrificial animal and discuss how to dismember his body and take it from the consulate. Jamal Khashoggi's friend, Turkish journalist Turan Kizlakci, wants the international community to act on the report.
Prince Salman.
The report is a black stain on Saudi Arabia's forehead. But Saudi Arabia has already dismissed the report, with its foreign minister tweeting that it contains clear contradictions and baseless allegations. Jamal Khashoggi was a United States resident, and the special rapporteur urged the FBI to open its own investigation and for the US government to take more action. But the Trump administration, which considers Mohammed bin Salman a key ally, has recently been taking extraordinary steps to ensure the US can continue selling weapons and nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia and maintain its support for Saudi involvement in the devastating war in Yemen. Republican Senator Kevin Cramer, who serves on the Armed Services Committee, told CNN the US should change its approach in light of the report.
We do have these many awkward relationships with allies, quasi-allies, you know, situational allies in the Middle East, and Saudi Arabia, of course, is one of those. And so how we move forward is not a trifling matter, but clearly I think we have to take a stand.
That's something President Trump has so far declined to do. From Jerusalem, this is Eric Twarczyk reporting for AM.
To discuss this case, the MH17 developments and her current trip to PNG, I was joined earlier by Australia's Foreign Minister Maurice Payne on the phone from Port Moresby. Maurice Payne, welcome to AM. What chance is there that these men named and charged over the MH17 case will ever front court?
We think this is a very important step, Sabra, and we very much welcome the announcement last night by the Joint Investigation Team. They've identified four individual suspects and suspicions of their responsibility for the acts that related to the downing of MH17 5 years ago. The anniversary is coming up very soon. We know that 38 people who were killed in that appalling act called Australia home. So we are strongly committed to working with our counterparts in the Joint Investigation Team to holding these perpetrators to account. And I would really like to commend the Australian Federal Police, who have been part of this process for all of these years now and have made a very significant contribution.
To the nub of that question, Minister, realistically, what chance is there that these men will front court?
Well, I think this is a long process, Sabra. It's not going to be concluded overnight. Nobody expects it to be quick and easy, and we have to work within the confines of the legal systems in the Netherlands and in Europe. But most importantly, we are working continuously with our partners in the Joint Investigation Team to endeavour to bring these people to justice. There are issues around extradition, certainly, because the constitutions in both Russia and Ukraine prohibit extraditing nationals. But we have requested, or the Dutch investigators have requested, mutual legal assistance, and we are very focused on assisting where we can.
Russia hasn't cooperated on this investigation. What makes Australia and our allies think they will now, and pressure for their extradition?
Well, we have actually had a first meeting of parties, including Russia, earlier this year, and that was an important step as well. It enabled first discussions to be had. And again, it is a very long process. There's no question about that. Our officials met in March. We are continuing to engage in these ongoing good faith talks. And it is a process that I think is very important for those families who were devastated by these events almost 5 years ago now.
On the UN Special Rapporteur's report on Jamal Khashoggi, do you agree with the conclusion that this was a state-sanctioned killing orchestrated by Saudi Arabia?
Well, as you know, the report was released overnight and is expected to be considered in detail next week in Geneva. I want to look at the recommendations. There are 13 in the report, but it clearly says the only conclusion to be made is that there is credible evidence that merits further investigation. And we have called for strenuous investigation of this atrocious event in diplomatic premises in Turkey. So we want to look very closely at the report. We're disappointed that the Special Rapporteur did not receive the cooperation and support that we believe her investigation deserved from Saudi Arabia and from some others. But given her determination on the face of it of a number of abuses of power and diplomatic immunities in the commission of this crime, I want to consider that in detail and then to determine further steps from Australia's perspective.
The US apparently wants to go softly in any action against Saudi Arabia. You've previously said that all options are on the table. Do you agree with the US approach?
Well, I maintain the position I've had since these events occurred. I've always said that there are investigations underway in Turkey itself, that the Special Rapporteur was conducting her investigation, and I wanted to see the results of both of those. Again, I understand Turkey and my counterpart in Turkey, Foreign Minister, has welcomed the Special Rapporteur's report, and I will look forward to speaking to him about that. We are very, very concerned and very distressed by what has happened to Mr. Khashoggi. It is outrageous that he was killed in this way in diplomatic premises. Any assessment would agree with that, in my view, and I'm looking forward to having a closer look at the report.
You've been in Papua New Guinea and Bougainville specifically. The region will hold an independence referendum in October, and it's expected they'll vote for independence. That's a huge problem for Australia, isn't it?
Well, I don't think the exercise of a democratic process in one of our nearest neighbours would be described as a huge problem for Australia. In fact, I had a very constructive visit to Bougainville yesterday. I was accompanied by the newly appointed Minister for Bougainville Affairs here in Papua New Guinea, Sepuka Temu, who is a highly regarded senior minister in the newly formed government, and was described by the acting president in Bougainville as a statesman, indeed. I met with the acting president yesterday and a number of his ministers, including his minister responsible for the Bougainville peace implementation. And this is a process which has been underway for some time. It was set out in the Bougainville Peace Agreement. One of the important things that Australia is focused on is not forming a view one way or the other about the outcome of a referendum in another country, but importantly supporting that where we can to ensure a credible and a peaceful and an inclusive process.
Minister, thanks for talking to AM.
Thanks very much, Sabra.
The Foreign Minister, Maurice Payne. Federal Parliament sits for the first time since the election in under a fortnight, and a major fight is looming over border protection, fuelled by a federal court ruling yesterday. The Home Affairs Minister says asylum seekers could try to make their way to Australia if Labor doesn't work with the federal government to abolish the Medivac legislation. Peter Dutton's told AM the court's judgment might result in new boat arrivals and he wants the law repealed, but Labor's accusing him of scaremongering. Political reporter Stephanie Boris reports.
The Home Affairs Minister has never been a fan of the Medivac legislation and he's using a recent federal court ruling to ramp up calls for it to be scrapped.
We can only clean it up if the Labor Party support the government in the Senate to abolish this bill.
The federal court has ruled doctors can recommend refugees on Nauru be transferred to Australia for treatment based on their medical records rather than speaking to them. Peter Dutton says he's concerned what will happen if the law isn't scrapped.
It may have applicability to many hundreds of people, which has certainly the potential to restart boats, and that would be a travesty.
How could it restart boats considering the Medivac legislation only applies to those that are currently on Manus Island and Nauru?
We're not dealing with honourable people. We're dealing with organised criminal syndicates who will spin and twist any message they possibly can to take money from innocent men, women and children.
The Shadow Home Affairs Minister, Christina Keneally, is confident the court ruling will not result in an influx of boats.
It does not apply to any new arrivals. There is no pull factor here. This is just scaremongering from the government.
David Burke is a senior lawyer at the Human Rights Law Centre who worked on the case.
This is something that's done every day in Australian hospitals where surgeons and specialists are recommending treatment for patients on the basis of detailed medical records. There's nothing controversial about this.
But Peter Dutton doesn't agree.
My fear now is there are hundreds of people in the pipeline. I think that is the reality.
The government warned that hundreds of people would come out under the Medivac legislation. That hasn't happened. You're now saying hundreds will come out under this ruling. So why should we believe you?
Well, Steph, we said that there would be no boats under a Liberal government. That's happened. We said that there would be boats under a Labor government. There were 50,000 people who arrived on 800 boats. That's the reality of what we're dealing with. And people, I believe, now will access the Medivac bill, and particularly with this ruling, which I'm seeking advice on as to what our appeal prospects might be.
The court ruling only applies to people on Nauru, where medical consultations via teleconference have been banned. Lawyers say they expect a handful of people will now apply for a medical transfer, but that might not happen because the government will try to abolish the legislation in the first week of Parliament. Christina Keneally says Labor doesn't agree with the move.
Labor supports the Medivac legislation, and Labor supports it for two reasons. One, it provides a way for people who are sick to get the health care that they need. And two, it ensures that the minister retains the power and the discretion to determine who comes into the country.
So far, about 30 people have been brought to Australia from Manus Island under the Medivac legislation.
Stephanie Boris reporting. The asylum debate in Australia is dominated by those who arrive on boats. When it comes to those arriving on planes, there's been a more than tripling of their numbers, raising fears that people smugglers are gaming the refugee system. In the past 5 years, 60,000 people, mostly from China and Malaysia, have come to Australia on temporary visas and then applied for asylum. Last financial year alone, there are around 28,000 such asylum claims. That's 10,000 more than at the peak of the boat arrivals crisis. Immigration Minister David Coleman says more than 90% of their claims are rejected and they're returned home. But that process can take years, and in the interim, the arrivals can work on bridging visas. A former senior immigration official says the traffickers are exploiting that time lag. Abul Rizvi was Deputy Secretary of the Immigration Department until 2007, and he's speaking here with Eleanor Whitehead.
Most onshore asylum seeker applications come in dribs and drabs. They come in from a wide variety of countries and they have a reasonably high success rate. When you have large numbers of asylum claims from just one or two countries and the vast majority are being refused, that is clear evidence that there is organisation behind this and that there are people doing this in order to profit.
We've seen a large number of these claims are being lodged by people from China and Malaysia. Why those two countries?
The scam out of Malaysia is a long-standing one. I first encountered it almost 20 years ago, and that appears to have re-emerged. It did re-emerge from time to time over the last 20 years, but it never got very large because we acted on it quite quickly. The surprising thing here is that it's got very, very large over a relatively short period of time, and that is the concern. In respect of China, I get the impression that the people smugglers have decided because it works so well out of Malaysia, they might as well give it a try out of China.
So more than 60,000 people arriving by plane to lodge asylum claims afterwards since 2014. Is this a border crisis?
It's certainly very concerning in terms of numbers. If you look at it over a reasonable period of time, it's larger than the boat arrival issue that the Rudd-Gillard government had to deal with. The other difference here, of course, is rather than the individuals being in detention centres, they are in the community. Because it's such a large continent, actually finding where they are will be a very substantial challenge.
And how difficult is it for people smugglers to bring people in through this route? What kind of a process are they going through to get people here?
There's probably going to be a team of people involved. There'll be people offshore who do the organising and bring people into the net, as it were. They will then arrange for them to get visitor visas via the Electronic Travel Authority to Australia. The individuals will probably be met just outside the airport and then taken to a place of work somewhere in Australia.
And so do we know what happens to them when they are here? Are they being trafficked specifically for work purposes?
Yes, that's very much what it's about. It's about enabling the traffickers to bring the relevant individuals in, to be able to place them in jobs, usually very low-skill jobs around Australia. There are three main areas in which these people have traditionally worked. Firstly, on farms, secondly, in restaurants, and thirdly, in brothels. If the processing times are not long, then the profitability of the exercise evaporates very quickly.
So why is it that there are more people now arriving by plane?
These schemes pop up from time to time. We've traditionally been able to identify them very quickly. By acting quickly, you make sure the numbers don't get too large and you're able to shut it down very quickly. If the people smugglers can't make a profit, they don't keep running them. The reason the numbers have got very large in this instance, it appears that Home Affairs has failed to act quickly enough, and I'm not even sure they're acting now, and the numbers have now become so large that actually taking action will be very, very expensive.
And that's Abul Rizvi, a former Deputy Secretary of the Immigration Department, and he was speaking there with our reporter Eleanor Whitehead. Australian scientists studying kids' tonsils have made a surprising discovery. ANU researchers have identified a new cell in the immune system. It regulates the antibodies created when someone has an extreme allergic reaction. And they say it could hold the key to treating other allergic reactions like asthma and life-threatening anaphylaxis. David Sparks reports.
Allergies are on the rise in Australia, and while some are relatively mild, others have a serious impact on people's lives.
It means you're living on the edge constantly of what he's got in his mouth, what he's got in his hands, what other kids have had to eat, what's on their hands.
Claire Ellsworth's 9-year-old son, Isaac, suffered his first anaphylactic reaction to dairy when he was 6 months old.
He had an anaphylactic reaction when I'd put some formula mixed with his rice cereal when he was just being weaned onto solids. And he was, you know, in the ambulance having his adrenaline within 20 minutes from there.
One of the cruel twists for people like Claire and Isaac is that an allergic reaction is, in a sense, a case of mistaken identity. It's the body's immune system wrongly identifying as a threat harmless particles like peanuts, dust, or pollen. The immune system then mounts a defensive response, which can come in the form of a runny nose during hay fever season, or, in more severe cases, aggressive inflammation like anaphylaxis. PhD scholar Pablo Canete is from the John Curtin School of Medical Research at ANU. He says for people with allergies, when the immune system overreacts like this, it produces antibodies called immunoglobulin, or IgE.
It is this IgE that begins a big cascade of events or chain of events that leads to very mild symptoms to very extreme inflammation in the case of life-threatening anaphylaxis.
Now the scientists at ANU have discovered a cell which they believe is supposed to regulate the production of IgE but fails to do so for people with allergies.
If you'd like to think the immune system as the army of a country, if the immune system, say, goes cuckoo bananas, let's just kill everything and let's mount a very aggressive attack, you're going to have a lot of collateral damage. The cell type that we've seen belongs to the family of these sort of controllers or policemen that just sort of tell the immune system to cool it. It's time to stop the attack because we're creating too much damage to our own country, to the body.
So where do you go from here now that you've identified this cell?
I think the next step is to actually learn more mechanisms of how this cell type regulates IgE. And from there, we can look. We can see how does this cell type mediate this control, and then we can think of harnessing these mechanisms to try and help these people that are suffering from allergic diseases.
And that's Pablo Canete from the John Curtin School of Medical Research at the Australian National University, and our reporter was David Sparks. Royal commissions and inquiries have made the devastating effects of violence against children clear to all Australians. Now, a new report from the Office of the New South Wales Advocate for Children and Young People is putting a price tag on that violence to the national economy, and the estimate is staggering. Tens of billions of dollars a year. Social affairs correspondent Norman Hermont reports.
On a sunny winter's day in a Sydney park, a woman we'll call Sarah talks about the toll violence she experienced as a child continues to take, even years later.
Trauma isn't just a one-time thing. You can't put a band-aid on it. You carry it with you for your entire life.
Economists commissioned by the Office of the New South Wales Advocate for Children and Young People have put a price tag on what it costs Australia for people like Sarah to carry the impact of that violence.
You spend the next 20 or 40 years unpacking all of that just to be able to move forward and move on in life.
A report found there were nearly 500,000 incidents of violence against children and young people in Australia in just 1 year. Andrew Johnson is the New South Wales Advocate for Children and Young People.
You could fill up the SCG, the MCG, the stadiums around the country multiple times over with the numbers of children.
The report estimates the cost to the national economy of violence against children and young people is more than $34 billion a year.
Costs are one way for people to understand the issue of violence against children, that it has a very strong impact on the community as a whole, but that's borne out by the costs that the numbers are so large.
The numbers are large because the report took into consideration not only costs like health services and child protection, but also the projected loss to the economy when those impacted by violence don't reach their full economic potential. Julie Hourigan-Roos from the peak body New South Wales Family Services says spending to prevent violence against children is not only the right thing to do, it's a good investment.
when we think about actually getting to all of these kids and giving these children and families the right support in the right places and at the right time, it makes absolute economic sense.
That's Julie Hourigan-Roos from New South Wales Family Services, ending Norman Hummont's report. And that is AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Angela Voipierre.
And I'm Stephen Stockwell, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
So in today's ep, we find out what it's like when you're suddenly homeless because the apartment you live in, which you definitely thought was safe, might actually be falling down.
That's what the residents of Mascot Tower are dealing with right now, and they have no idea when they'll be allowed back into their homes.
It's not the first time this has happened, and it probably won't be the last. So what's wrong with Australian high-rises?
That's today on The Signal. You can find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.